Good evening. The subject I was asked to speak about this week may not be something that is immediately familiar to you. I received an email from Lowell about a month ago, and there was a request, I don't know from whom, but someone in the congregation requested that we spend some time talking about the history of the Judaizing teachers. And that term may not be immediately familiar to you, but I think as the course of the study unfolds, you might understand what we're talking about a little bit better. The Judaizing teachers were a group of Jewish Christians who sought to impose upon the Gentiles an observance of the law of Moses. And there was a great deal of that teaching in the first century, and a lot of the New Testament, well, I shouldn't say a lot of the New Testament, a significant portion of Paul's letters address the issue of these Judaizing teachers. And if I understand the request correctly, the idea was for us to look at the history of the Judaizing teachers, to answer the question, were they just concerned with circumcision only, and also to consider how the church fought against false teaching in the first century, and what lessons we might draw from that. And then use that as, I guess you might say, sort of a springboard into later this week, talking about false teaching that faces us as the church today, and how we can follow the model that we see in the New Testament of standing firm in the face of false teaching. I thought this week it might be good to begin with just to take a few minutes to establish some context. The Judaizing teachers don't just appear out of nowhere. This wasn't just a movement that sprang from nothing. And I think when we look at particularly the book of Acts, what we're going to see is there's a deep connection between what the Judaizers were insisting upon and what the Pharisees upheld among the Jewish people. So I thought it might be good to spend a couple of nights, one or two nights, just talking about the Pharisees in general. And I think if we do that, if we take that time to just consider the Pharisees, it might make this whole transition into the Judaizing teachers a little bit more natural rather than just jumping straight in to the topic I've been asked to address. I think you'll probably all recognize, if you have any level of familiarity with the Old Testament, the word Pharisee is not found in the Old Testament. We don't know exactly where the Pharisees came from. We know that the Jewish nation was controlled by the Greeks in the 2nd century B.C., and that the Greeks sought to Hellenize the Jewish people. They sought to impose their customs and in particular their religion upon the Jewish people. And you might remember a name of a family by the name of Maccabee who stood up against that Greek influence. They led a very successful rebellion against the Seleucid Empire, the Greek Empire, and ended up wresting control from that empire, and Israel became a nation by itself. As far as we can tell, the Pharisees sprang out of that Maccabean rebellion. They are the heirs, if you will, of the Maccabees. Our history on this time period is just a little sketchy, and so there's just not a whole lot I can really say. Our best source on this period in history is Josephus, and Josephus was a Pharisee, so he's a little difficult to believe at times because we just can't tell how much of what he was saying is true and how much of what he was saying was just embellishment to make the Jewish people look better in the eyes of the Romans. See, Josephus was writing this very long history in order to help the Romans understand the history of the Jewish people, and at times he does tend to embellish their history. So it's a little difficult to know for sure the origins of the Pharisees, but we know by the first century there is this group of people, this group of men that numbered about 6,000, this select group called the Pharisees. And these people become the main adversaries of Jesus during his ministry. Now, there's several different groups, several different sects within Judaism in the first century. Of course, the two main ones are going to be the Pharisees and the Sadducees, right? Pharisees and the Sadducees. We know even less about the Sadducees of the first century. The Sadducees were primarily the priests, the high priests. And when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, the Sadducees basically fell off the face of Judaism completely. The Pharisees really are the ones who took hold of the Jewish people from 70 AD onward and became the later became the rabbis that put together the Talmud, put together all those writings like the Gemara and the Mishnah and all those names that don't really mean a whole lot to a lot of us. But Judaism as we see it today really is dominated by the people who are descended from the Pharisees, not literally as in their heritage, but more descendants in their ideology, if you will. The Sadducees, we really don't know a whole lot about them. They disappear off the scene in 70 AD. Josephus has a few things to say about them, but once again, we're left to question whether or not Josephus is an accurate conveyor of that information because he was a Pharisee. The Pharisees and the Sadducees didn't get along. They had very different beliefs. We know that the Sadducees believed in the written word alone, and there is some debate as to what that exactly meant. It seems to me, based on what I've read in recent weeks, that the Sadducees accepted the first five books of the Old Testament as inspired, and the rest of the Old Testament as we know it, they questioned whether or not it really was from God. The other things we know about the Sadducees is that they did not believe in a spirit, they did not believe in angels, and they did not believe in the resurrection. And we know that because of what Luke tells us in the book of Acts. Remember, Paul is in front of the Sanhedrin, and he discerns that there's a group of Sadducees and a group of Pharisees, so he starts a fight over the resurrection there. And Luke comments that the Sadducees denied the existence of a spirit, denied the existence of angels, and denied the resurrection. And that's basically, in a nutshell, what we know about the Sadducees. We don't know a whole lot else. Now, there's a few other groups that we see in the New Testament, a couple of others. We have the Zealots. One of Jesus' disciples was a Zealot, Simon the Zealot, or Simon the Canaanite. The Zealots were a Jewish patriotic party who were fanatical defenders of the theocracy, and who, while taking vengeance on those who wronged it, were themselves guilty of great excesses. They believed that the theocracy should be in place, that that should be what ruled the Jewish nation, so they would be the ones who would look to the line of David to be restored, and the heir apparent of David to be reigning on the throne in Jerusalem. And in fact, the Zealots are really the sect among the Jews who drove the Romans to destroy Jerusalem in 70 AD. They were the ones that were sort of egging that revolt on. They really stoked the fire of rebellion and ended up all dying, basically, because they wouldn't give up to the last man. And so Titus massacred them in the end. So we have the Zealots, and then we also have another group called the Herodians. And they're only mentioned a couple of times. The Herodians were probably formed under Herod the Great, and it appears that they held it was right to pay homage to a sovereign who might be able to bring the friendship of Rome and other advantages, but who had personally no title to reign by law and religion. In other words, they were very sympathetic to Rome's rule. They sort of were sycophants. They, if you will, they were looking to make themselves good in the eyes of Rome. They wanted to have that sort of political power, if you will. So we have the Herodians, the Zealots, the Sadducees. And then one final group that's not mentioned, but they are a major group, and that's the Essenes. And I only mention the Essenes because sometimes when you're reading commentaries or you're reading books about church history, one of the things that's commonly brought up is this theory that John the Baptizer was an Essene. He was baptizing in a region of the Jordan where the Essenes were known to congregate. The Essenes were sort of a group of people that were removed from society, a lot like our Amish and Mennonite people. They sort of separated themselves from society. They had a closed community. They had some special rites, some special ceremonies that they performed. And it was all located in this region around the Jordan River as it empties into the Dead Sea. You all have heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I'm sure. The Dead Sea Scrolls were actually from the Essene community. That cave in Qumran is right around that ancient Essene community. So we have them to thank for that, for the preservation of those documents. These were the major sects of first century Judaism, and in all five of these, I think we would all agree that the two that draw Jesus' attention the most are, of course, the Pharisees and Sadducees. And of those two, the Pharisees are by far the most prominent. Now, there are three other names that are often mentioned in conjunction with the Pharisees. A lot of times we'll see the Pharisees and scribes linked together. We'll also see the teachers of the law. We'll also see lawyers. And from what I've been able to determine, the scribes, the teachers of the law, and the lawyers were all the same group. Basically, those are names, interchangeable names, to describe the same group of people. The scribe was a role that evolved from the time of the kings onward. During the monarchy, the scribe performed what we would call secretarial work. They copied things, they kept accounts for the king. They were basically glorified secretaries. However, Ezra, the 5th century priest and scribe, engaged himself in actively teaching the law to the people. And Ezra really is the prototypical scribe. He's the one that sort of breaks the boundary, if you will, on what the scribe's duty encompassed. And after Ezra, we see the scribes basically breaking away from the priesthood. Ezra was both a priest and a scribe, and slowly over the course of a couple centuries, the scribes actually broke away from the priesthood and became their own separate entity, if you will. They did this because the priests following Ezra were not doing a very good job in educating the people on the law. Malachi, the prophet who came after Ezra, records this in Malachi chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. He says, "For the lips of a priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But you have departed from the way, you have caused many to stumble at the law, you have corrupted the covenant of Levi." So already, just a couple of decades, just a few decades after Ezra had passed away, Malachi is telling the priests, "You're slacking in your duties. You're supposed to be teaching the people the law, but you're not doing that. You're supposed to impart to them the knowledge of God, and you are not performing that duty. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi." We learn through historical sources that the priesthood in the next couple centuries was also tainted by Hellenism, and I mentioned that a couple of minutes ago. Hellenism was this idea of imposing Greek culture and Greek religion upon the nations who were ruled by Greece. And the priesthood during the time that Greece ruled Israel was very sympathetic to Hellenism. They allowed the input, the influence of Hellenism into the nation. And so we see from Ezra really onward this split between the scribe and the priests. And the scribes essentially became the class of people who took over the duty of teaching the law to the Israelites. They were performing what the priests should have been performing. They resisted the Greek influences, and they became the staunch defenders and teachers of divine revelation. Now, unbeknownst to me before I started this study, and I've learned some of this in the last few weeks, the scribes and Pharisees were two distinct groups. We often see them linked together. We often see Pharisees and scribes, or scribes and Pharisees, just put together many, many times in the books of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But as far as I can tell, the scribes and Pharisees were actually two separate groups. Some scribes were Pharisees, but not all Pharisees were scribes. In Acts chapter 5, verse 34, Gamaliel is identified as both a Pharisee and a teacher of the law. Gamaliel was both a Pharisee and a scribe, if you will. But the scribes were not identical with the Pharisees. Most of the scribes accepted the principles of the Pharisees, and the Pharisees followed the teachings derived from scribal interpretations. And that statement's going to have a lot more meaning in about 10 minutes, at least I hope it does if I do my job correctly. The Pharisees followed after the scribes' teaching. They believed that the scribes had the inside track on God's will for the people. So we have these two distinct groups, the scribes and the Pharisees. The scribes were sympathetic to the Pharisees' ways, but not all of them were Pharisees. And the Pharisees followed the teachings of the scribes. So there's some overlap, and yet they are two distinct groups. I'm going to pause here for just a moment and ask, are there any questions or comments? And if there are at any point this week, just raise your hand and stop me, especially if I'm not making any sense. So, anything. All right. Well, let's talk about the Pharisees for a few minutes now. That just sort of sets the table for what we have in the first century. We've got this divided nation, this sectarian nation divided up into all these small little groups, the most exclusive of which are the Pharisees. And when we look at the Pharisees, we're going to notice in the New Testament several major characteristics. And I'm hoping that over the course of these next couple nights, I can draw out those characteristics so that they'll be fairly plain to everyone. The first thing that I think of when I think of the Pharisees and the scribes is I think of the traditions of men. In the 15th chapter of Matthew, verse 2, Jesus is asked the question, "Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders?" Jesus' disciples were not washing their hands, and the Pharisees asked Jesus, "Why are your disciples transgressing the tradition of the elders?" I want you to notice that phrase, the tradition of the elders. Paul relates to us his life prior to his conversion when he was more exceedingly zealous for the traditions of my fathers. Galatians chapter 1, verse 14. Peter tells us in his first epistle, well, I should say he tells his Jewish audience, Jewish Christian audience, that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 18. Paul warns the Colossians, "Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ." Colossians chapter 2, verse 8. Now, these are four passages, but as I understand the scriptures, all these passages are connected together. Christ was asked why his disciples did not observe the customs that the Pharisees and scribes observed. Paul said that he was very fervent for these customs. Peter says our Jewish brethren were redeemed by the precious blood of Christ from these customs, from these traditions. And Paul warns that we should not allow these or any other man-made tradition to lead us away from the Lord. These traditions of the elders, traditions of the fathers, customs of the fathers, however you want to put it, All of these are talking about the same thing. The Pharisees and scribes believe that on Mount Sinai, God revealed two laws. He revealed a written law, and he revealed an oral law. These oral laws were what the scribes and Pharisees held to. This is what they kept. And these oral laws seemed to fall into three different categories. You had oral laws that were simultaneously given to Moses alongside the written laws and then passed down from generation to generation by word of mouth. You also had in those traditions decisions by various judges that became precedents in judicial matters. And I think that will become clear in just a moment. You also had in those oral traditions interpretations of great rabbis that were revered as equal with Scripture. So these traditions of men fell into three categories. You've got this passing of an oral law. You've got these judgments. And you also have interpretations. These were the traditions of the elders. And they were held by the scribes and Pharisees to be on equal footing with the written word of God. So when Jesus is, well, rebuked, if you will, by the Pharisees and scribes for his disciples not washing their hands, according to the tradition of the elders, the Pharisees were saying, here you've got this command, this tradition that is equal with the written word. Why are you allowing your disciples to violate that? That's a sin, just like as if you weren't following the written law. Now, I hope we all understand this idea of there being an oral law passed down from Moses to the next generation has no scriptural validity whatsoever. I'm aware of no passage in the Old Testament that attests to the existence of this oral law. And there's no way for us to track it backwards. Scripture doesn't talk about it, and history does not record it. So as far as I'm concerned, this is just one of those Jewish fables. Those fables that they were famous for coming up with, and we could go over numerous examples of those. These other two categories, though, do have some legitimacy, and we're going to see why in just a second. Now, they're not equal with the written law. Don't mistake my meaning. But these were a part of the fabric of the scribes and Pharisees' doctrine. These oral traditions and oral laws primarily came from the scribes. The scribes were the ones that were responsible for putting all these things together. That's why the Pharisees leaned upon the scribes. The scribes came up with these oral traditions. They came up with these judgments. They came up with these interpretations. The scribes really had three main duties. They were teachers, they were interpreters, and they were judges. Teachers, interpreters, and judges. And they had a very elaborate system of how all this was done. For instance, with regard to the role of the interpreter, what they would do is scribes, individual scribes, would form an opinion about a certain passage in the old law. Let's take a very simple one. What constitutes work on the Sabbath? Well, one scribe would come up with an answer. Well, this is what I think the law of Moses means here. And then another scribe would come up with a different answer. And another scribe would come up with a different answer. And so you had this body of scribes, if you will, that came up with all sorts of different interpretations. Then they would each take their interpretation and they would discuss it among themselves until they reached some sort of consensus point of view. And once they reached that consensus point of view, they would say, "Thus saith the Lord." This is what God intended in the law of Moses. So that's how interpretation worked. The teacher role was a little different. Scribes had schools that they taught, schools that were often connected with the synagogue. Remember Gamaliel. Paul says that he was raised in Jerusalem at the feet of Gamaliel. Well, Gamaliel was one of these scribes, a teacher of the law. He had a school, presumably in Jerusalem. That's what Paul says. He had a school in Jerusalem, and Paul went to that school, and it was attached to a synagogue. And Gamaliel would impart to his students this oral law. And it was very important that they memorize this oral law, because it was passed down by word of mouth from generation to generation. So they spent a great deal of time memorizing, committing these things to memory, making sure every word was just exactly right, because those students were then responsible for passing it on to the next generation. As far as the judges are concerned, the scribes, because they knew the law so well, because they had the written law committed to memory, because they had the oral traditions committed to memory, the scribes were often called upon to settle disputes between people. If you had this dispute over some land, a scribe was called in. Because they knew the law, they should be able to give an educated, respected opinion on what should be done. So that's the role of the scribe in the first century. And as I've noted several different times, these were the oral traditions. These were the traditions of the elders, and they were not written down until the 3rd century BC. They were finally, 3rd century AD, pardon me. 3rd century AD, they were written down in a work that's known as the Mishnah. And to the Mishnah was added another work called the Gemara, and the Gemara is a commentary on the Mishnah, and you put the Gemara and the Mishnah together, and you get a Talmud. That's where the Talmud comes from. So you've got the oral traditions, the Mishnah. You've got the Gemara, which is the commentary on the oral law. And you put those two together and you have the Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud is, of course, the most influential of all of them. So that's how the scribes operated. So the Pharisees followed the scribes' interpretations of the law. The scribes were the teachers of the Pharisees, and the scribes were the ones the Pharisees turned to adjudicate matters between individuals. Now I'm going to pause here for a moment. Is everybody with me? Is it warm to anyone else in here? Because I'm burning up. Okay. I think it's just these lights. Either that or I'm really nervous. Maybe both. All right. Now let's see this at work. And we can look at a couple of different examples, but I really think the best one is found in the 19th chapter of Matthew. And I'm going to spend some time looking at this. Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 12. And I understand by looking at this particular example that I'm touching on a subject that is a sensitive topic. And I want you to know going into my presentation on this matter that I am the son of divorced parents. So I understand how difficult this issue is, and I'm certainly not wanting to create any sort of feelings inside of anyone by looking at this issue. But as I was trying to figure out a way to illustrate how the scribes and Pharisees worked, Matthew 19 really is the best example I can turn to sort of illustrate how all of this came about. And I think it's a very... How shall I say this? It's a very good example to look at, because I think it's a warning to us. And I'll get to what I mean by that here in just a moment. How the scribes interpreted and applied the law is well illustrated by Christ's conversation here in Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 12. Now, I think it is possible to understand precisely what Christ means by not introducing some external information that I'm about to introduce. But I want to sort of set it in the context of the time to look at some historical information, because I think that does help us understand what precisely Christ is being asked to determine in this. In Matthew chapter 19, verse 3, the Pharisees come to Jesus and they ask him a very specific question. And I want you to notice how they word this question. They say, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" That phrase, for just any reason, is a very important phrase. This question stems from the teachings of a Jewish rabbi by the name of Hillel. Hillel. And Hillel lived in the century preceding Christ's birth. He was one of the most influential rabbis of that time, and indeed has remained one of the most influential rabbis of any era. Hillel's ideas on divorce were opposed by another rabbinic school by the name of Shammai. Okay? So we have these two rabbinical schools, Hillel and Shammai. They disagreed on what? On the grounds for divorce. And basically, the main dispute concerned a new interpretation of Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1. The Hillelites allowed divorce for any reason based on Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1. And if you turn over, keep your finger here in Matthew 19, if you turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1, I'll show you exactly why they permitted this. In Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1, the school of Hillel interpreted this verse this way. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. Now, the Hillelites interpreted that phrase that's in your New King James. I'm not sure how the King James translates this. They interpreted that phrase, some uncleanness, very liberally. Another translation of this same verse translates that same phrase as a matter of indecency. Now, the Shammaiites interpreted this in a whole different way. The Hillelites were basically saying a man can divorce his wife for any reason. He finds something in her that he doesn't like, he can just divorce her. The school of Shammai, though, said that a man could only divorce his wife for four reasons: childlessness, material neglect, emotional neglect, and unfaithfulness. Now, there was a serious disagreement between these two schools. And for a time, the school of Shammai was the dominant point of view in the Jewish community. But by the time of Christ, the school of Hillel had become the dominant point of view. The Jewish people had come to accept their interpretation of divorce and the permissiveness of divorce as for any reason. And that had become the norm in Jewish society at this time. The Lord's answer to this debate, I think, is incredibly insightful. It's insightful to me because the Lord doesn't enter into this squabble over words. He doesn't get into defining what some uncleanness means. He doesn't even broach that topic. His justification, or for his justification, Jesus looks back to a principle which precedes the law. And that's God's original design for marriage. Divorce was impossible for Adam and Eve, and it should be seen by man as a nearly impossible alternative. Man should not separate what God has joined together. That's what Jesus is saying. God has joined these people together, and man should not separate them. Now, verses 7 and 8, the Pharisees come back to him, and they say, "Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" We've got these two schools that are fighting over what this passage means, Hillel and Shammai. You've got these two different interpretations. Jesus says neither interpretation is right. He goes clear back to before the law and says, this is what God's will is for people. And what you guys have been arguing about for the better part of a century now is irrelevant. And so the Pharisees ask, well, then why did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? Notice that word, command. The rabbis had concluded that adultery and childlessness were grounds for compulsory divorce. There are occasions where rabbis would actually force a man and a woman to divorce, even when it was against their will. And so these people concluded that Moses essentially commanded divorce in such circumstances. Now Jesus comes back to them and he couches divorce not as a command, but as a concession. He says in verse number 8, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. Even though one could keep the law and divorce his or her spouse, they were not forced or compelled to do so. They were only permitted under the law. That's what Jesus was saying. And in his judgment, Jesus narrows the school of Shammai. Remember, Shammai said you could divorce your wife, or a man could divorce his wife for a number of different reasons. Hillel opened it wide up and said for any reason. Jesus narrows the scope down to one central issue. He sanctions it only in the case of adultery. And his reasoning was based upon a principle that precedes and exceeds the law. God's design for marriage. It's not based upon some extrapolation of what a passage means. It's not based upon a discussion between two rabbinical schools. It's based upon a principle that we see in the first two chapters of Genesis. God's design for marriage. I think that this illustrates how the scribal community determined what was lawful and unlawful. They solicited the input of respected teachers, and through discussion, they reached a consensus point of view. Jesus was asked to weigh in on a debate that had raged for the better part of a century between two major rabbinical schools. What started out as a minority view, the view of Hillel, had become the predominant view in first century Judaism. Jesus says neither tradition is correct, neither interpretation is correct, and he appeals to God's fundamental design for marriage. And I want you to keep in the back of your mind Jesus' approach on this issue. Because this is an approach that Paul is going to use, particularly in the books of Galatians and Romans, in demonstrating justification through faith. Paul is going to reach back before the law to the father of the Jewish people, to Abraham. And he's going to demonstrate that Abraham is the father of all who believe, whether they be Jew or Greek. And since Abraham preceded the law by 430 years, the promise that God gave to Abraham supersedes the giving of the law. So Jesus' approach is something that Paul uses as well when he's arguing against the Judaizers. Now I'll pause here for a moment and I'll ask, are there any questions or comments?
So basically it was only man's right.
That's a very interesting question, Ryan. A woman divorcing her husband was common in the Greco-Roman world. It was very common among the Greeks and the Romans for a woman to divorce her husband. It was less common in the Jewish world. And there are a few pieces of historical evidence that suggest that women did divorce their husbands in the first century. I would also point out what Jesus teaches over in the book of Mark chapter 10. In Mark chapter 10, which is the parallel passage, Jesus says in verses 11 and 12, Mark 10, 11 and 12, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her, and if a woman divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. So that does give us an indication that though it was uncommon, women were divorcing their husbands in the first century, among the first century Jews. So, was very uncommon. Mike, was that a hand? Oh, I was really hoping. No, it was not. No. Yeah. And the way... Go ahead. Yeah, which is just another piece of evidence how, you know, how things had progressed from what God had revealed to this very elaborate system of beliefs. And, you know, the reason why I'm taking us through all this is because I think there is an object lesson in all of this. And the lesson, at least, that I've taken away from it is we've got to be really careful about these judgment calls, about applying Scripture. You know, when I think back to the last 30 years of my life, that doesn't sound like a lot of time to some of you, I know. But when I think back to the last 30 years of my life, marriage, divorce, and remarriage is one of those topics where it seems like we're always trying to get evangelists to weigh in on what they think is legitimate and not legitimate, illegitimate, right? I've heard these discussions at 2 week meetings and in Eminence and all those other meetings. We're always wanting to get somebody's opinion on it, and I think, and I understand why, but I think there's also a great danger in that, because we don't want to become like the Pharisees and scribes, where we're trying to reach these consensus points of view, establishing doctrine, establishing judgments for the entire brotherhood. I think we need to shy away from that. And that's one of the lessons that I've taken away from this particular part of my study. And when we look later on at the issue of the Judaizing teachers, we're going to see the brethren in Jerusalem coming together to decide a matter. And it's going to appear that that's precisely what's taking place. That they've got this question and they're coming together to make some sort of determination. And when we get over to Acts 15, I want to take a different look at it perhaps than maybe what you've looked at it in the past, because I think there's something totally different going on. I'm beginning to ramble here. Back to my point, I think we just need to be really careful that we don't get into this situation where, you know, we're favoring one school of thought over the other or one judgment call over the other. I think that that's dangerous, dangerous territory. And we don't want to follow the example of these guys. So, anything else? Mike, you're exactly right, though. This was something that had been developed way down the road. It was not according to what God had revealed originally. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, and that's just the nature of the created realm. Things tend to move from design into chaos, and that's basically what you've got. Once you permit something, it's only inevitably going to descend into something else, something lower, something less organized, if you will. So, is that entropy? Is that what that's called, Mark? Yeah, entropy. Hey, I got that one right. That's my one for the week. All right. Okay. Now, I did bring up one other example of this over in Matthew chapter 15. I brought this up a few minutes ago when I was talking about this idea of tradition. In Matthew chapter 15, we have Jesus approached by some Pharisees from Jerusalem asking why his disciples did not wash their hands according to the tradition of the elders. And there is an interesting aspect to this in Jesus' response. And it's important because I think it illustrates another principle that we need to keep our minds wrapped around. In verse number 4, Jesus says, "For God commanded, saying, 'Honor your father and mother,' and 'He who curses father and mother, let him be put to death.' But you say, 'Whoever says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is a gift to God,' or korban, then he need not honor his father or mother. Thus you have made the commandment of God of no effect by your tradition." This is one of the the casualties, if you will, of a human-contrived system of traditions is that those traditions are inevitably going to begin contradicting Scripture. And that this is just one example of it. Jesus talks about this oath that a man could make. He could swear that none of his possessions would be given to his mother or father when they are needed. And this oath was upheld by the scribes, by the Pharisees. They said, this is perfectly legitimate. He's made an oath before God. He cannot break that oath. And Jesus says, by allowing him to keep that oath, he is actually violating a commandment of God. One of the ten. So when you've got this system of contrived tradition, this developed, intricate, well-oiled machine, inevitably what you're going to have are contradictions with Scripture. And that's precisely what we see at work in Jesus' teaching here in Matthew 15, verses 3 through 6. I'll pause here. I'm thinking we probably need to ring the bell in just a couple minutes. Are there any other questions or comments about this? Anybody? All right. Okay, well, we'll pick up with the Pharisees again tomorrow night, Lord willing. We'll talk about their hypocrisy. We'll talk about their ideas of purity. And hopefully by the end of tomorrow night, we'll begin pointing our attention toward the Judaizing teachers. As I said, I think a lot of these things are going to begin to play into what we see at work with the Judaizing teachers. A lot of how Christ approaches his teachings to the Pharisees and scribes are going to be echoed by the New Testament writers later on. So I think that looking at the Pharisees and scribes is a good starting place, because these Judaizing teachers just didn't pop out of nowhere. I believe they were largely a Pharisee in origin, or at least influenced by the Pharisees and scribes. So, thank you all for being here, for your questions and comments, and Lord willing, we'll continue tomorrow night.